Once in a generation, sometimes once in a lifetime, a singular event blindsides the entire planet. 25 years on, does the memory of the 9/11 attacks against New York's Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, does that fade into history? Or is it still as raw and vivid as on that sunny September morning? Back then, the world was still processing the end of the Cold War. Western spies who'd learned Russian suddenly had to take Arabic lessons. The element of surprise compounded by the shock of this non-state actor group killing thousands on U.S. soil. Each big anniversary since has been a marker of its own time. 10 years ago, it was the wake of the Paris attacks and ISIS's bid to establish a caliphate in Syria and Iraq. 5 years ago, it was during COVID, when the whole planet faced a whole new unforeseen common challenge. We'll ask our panel how the present informs the past, how the past informs the present, a present that's more connected and plugged in, but also more fractured, what with the balance of power between all allies and rivals currently in flux, and the blowback against globalization perhaps felt in different ways. What can we learn from September 11th? Today in the France 24 debate, 9/11 now and then. With us, he was in New York on the day, joining us from San Sebastian, Spain, human rights attorney Reed Brody. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
We'll be joined shortly from Jerusalem by Jocelyne Cesari, Chair of Religion and Politics at the University of Birmingham, author of God's People, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism in the World of Nations. From Tangiers, Morocco, Craig Capitis, columnist at Turquia Today. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, Francois.
Karim Emid Bitar, professor at the St. Joseph University of Beirut and the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We thank our ever-growing number of viewers listening as well to the France 24 debate, wherever podcasts are streamed. Reed Brody, what does September 11th mean to you? What did what was your September 11th like in 2001?
Well, I was in New York, as you said. It was my son's second day at nursery school, and we watched the smoke coming from the towers from his classroom window. First, I saw the smoke coming out of one tower, and I didn't see the planes hit, but we saw then the smoke coming out of the second tower, and it was obviously a terrorist attack. And we went home. My wife, who was a nurse, rushed to the hospital to see if she could be of help. But what really I really take away, by the time I got home, my inbox, and I'm, as you said, a human rights lawyer, was filled with messages from friends in places like Chad and Cambodia and El Salvador, people who lived with violence, and suddenly it was our turn. And it was a moment of great solidarity in New York. I mean, there's no transportation. It was a big village. We had stranded travelers sleeping on our floors. And watching people, walking the streets of New York, holding photos of the missing, I kept thinking of the families of the disappeared in Latin America. We briefly became, a city of the disappeared. And that instinct, to reach for solidarity across suffering is what could have shaped the response. And instead, as I hope we'll discuss, President Bush chose confrontation. He chose wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, a war on terror marked by the humiliation of Muslim prisoners. It really responded, unfortunately, the way that the terrorists probably would have wanted him to respond. And I think that's part of why we are where we are today.
Yeah, the big difference at Ground Zero this year will be that there's a new mayor, 34-year-old Zoran Mamdani, who Wednesday inaugurated a new wall to honor 9/11 first responders at Police Plaza in Lower Manhattan.
I know many of you who worked on the pile are here today. I also know that far too many are not. Over the last 25 years, we have lost more than 450 officers to 9/11-related illnesses. They were fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers, and they were New Yorkers through and through. In everything they gave to their loved ones, their neighbors, their communities, and the pride they held for this city, and in the sacrifice they made without hesitation.
So, Reed Brody, what are your thoughts listening to that clip?
Well, you know, I worked on Zoran Mandani's campaign. You know, first Muslim mayor. He's going to be attending this ceremony at Ground Zero, despite a lot of opposition, you know, from Rudy Giuliani and from, you know, the right wing commentators. Although a poll showed, you know, that 3/4 of New Yorkers believe he should be there. And, you know, Mandani is a particularly good politician. I mean, he never ran away from being a Muslim. He never hid it. He spoke openly about the prejudice he faced growing up as a Muslim in New York. And of course, he was attacked as an anti-Semitic, especially because of his criticism of Netanyahu in Israel. I'm Jewish myself, and I get messages from relatives all the time. But you know, he has proven to be a healer, somebody who embodies that inclusiveness that I think we need going ahead.
Craig Capitis, that brings us to why you decided to spend this September 11th, this 25th anniversary, in Tangiers. Tell us where you are exactly.
One set.
Most in the Muslim world stretches back to 1786 when the first envoy came over here. Then our first ambassador arrived in 1797. And then in 1821, the Sultan of Morocco gave this building for perpetuity to the American government. It is still owned by the American government. It's been turned into a museum and kind of think tank. And I've been spending the day here watching tourists come through and talk to them about why and how did a certain political party in America marinate itself in an inexhaustible stew of revenge and resentment against the Muslim community. It's been a fascinating day.
What did you learn?
I learned that the American legation here in Tangier is pretty much the State Department's field of dreams. The people coming through here are glassy-eyed. They're wanting the old America. This used to be, for example, a Peace Corps outpost for some time. The staff here now, it's all volunteer. They teach literacy, both Arabic literacy and English language literacy. Oddly, the building is still owned by the United States government, and they charged the NGO that runs it, $1 a month. And it is a field of dreams. Build it and they will come. The people who come through here looking at the stuff on the wall, the old memos and cables stretching back to 1821, show a time when Americans didn't have any problems with the Islamic world. In fact, we were friends with them. We shared ideas. In fact, this very room that I'm in, the dining room, as it is known, was where many of the meetings between Islamic officials and American diplomats took place starting in 1821. And according to the old memos that I've seen so far, the cables, discussions with the historians, never once in that history did any American heap any opprobrium or say anything negative about Islam.
So you heard Reed Brody talking about the mood of solidarity in New York City in the days that followed September 11th. You remember, because you were in Paris at the time, that front page of newspaper Le Monde, which put as its lead editorial, "Today we are all Americans." Can that "we are all Americans" sentiment return?
The feeling here of the Americans who have come through here today, by the way, there's some 40,000 of them a year who come here through these halls, is that they're hoping that it will return. But they've all so far have expressed a sense of it's going to be a long slog because, you know, let's face it, what MAGA and others did is they turned faith. Faith became a suspicion, then suspicion becomes fear, and fear, the oldest currency in the political racket, becomes votes. And that is what's going on in a nutshell in the United States. Fear and loathing against Muslims. You could look up the statistics. Since February 2025 through March 2026, according to the research that we have done, 89 Republican elected officials have participated in anti-Muslim attacks over social media. And that those attacks are growing. And the folks who have been coming through here today, and I'll be speaking with more of them tomorrow for my article, are astonished and embarrassed by this.
Craig Capitas, so many thanks for joining us live from that historic site. Karim Emile Bitar, let me ask you, before I ask you about your September 11th, let me ask you to react a little bit. Can you know, that feeling of we are all Americans return? Because remember, after 2001, there was the invasion of Iraq. Public opinion turned against the United States. And then there was the election of Barack Obama. Everybody here in France loved America suddenly again.
Absolutely. The problem with the editorial, we are all Americans, is not the sense of solidarity. We all felt solidarity with America. I'm personally reluctant to use these all-encompassing terms like America, Islam. There's no such thing as a single Islamic civilization, as a single Western civilization. And you mentioned Zohran Mamdani, one of the academics who wrote most eloquently about 9/11 and its aftermath was actually Mamdani. His father, Mahmoud Mamdani, who's a professor at Columbia University. He wrote a book called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America and the Global War on Terror. And he denounced what we are currently still witnessing, what he called culture talk, culturalism, essentialism, this idea that all Muslims think alike, that all Americans think alike. The tragedy with September 11 was that people in the Muslim world, some radicals essentialized America, perceived all Americans as guilty of the injustices of U.S. foreign policies. So basically, 9/11 was an immense American tragedy. The problem is that what followed was an immense American strategic error that ended up deepening the fault lines and tragically strengthening the narrative of terrorists across the world, particularly the war in Iraq. One could argue that Afghanistan was a war of necessity, but Iraq was definitely a war of choice based on false information, on peddling information that we totally know today was completely debunked about weapons of mass destruction. The media has a huge part of responsibility. Serious news outlets at the time said a guy named Curveball, made up by Judith Miller, had passed information that Saddam was in cahoots with Al-Qaeda. Today, we all know it was fake, so it was an unforgivable mistake, and the Middle East is still paying the price of these misguided interventions in the Middle East.
When you look back to September 11th, George W. Bush, yes, he's the one who launched that war that you described in Iraq in 2003. But there's also this moment, 6 days after the attacks, so the President of the United States visiting the Washington Islamic Center, where he stated, Islam is peace. At the time, he warned against chastising an entire religion. More recently, he was asked about that.
I didn't want us to lose our soul. I wanted to, as we defended our freedoms, I wanted people to remember how precious they are. So one of the things that I did, and I think you were very much involved in this decision shortly thereafter, was to go to a mosque.
So George W. Bush, who you're saying has a lot to answer for when it comes to Iraq. But here, he did go out of his way in the days that followed to say what you just said, that that it's a religion. It doesn't represent necessarily...
Absolutely. This is a sad irony. 25 later, George W. Bush appears like a wise elder, appears, would be described by the MAGA folks as some sort of woke Islamo-leftist, simply because he made a distinction between Islam as a religion and radical terrorists. So it says a lot lot about the increasing polarization in America. Indeed, at the time, most Republican politicians, whether George W. Bush or John McCain, made this distinction. Today, it has become the major talking point that we hear is Islam is evil. And they still talk about Islam as if it were a homogeneous entity, one block facing Western civilization, and as if the grievances were directed at American way of life. It is clearly directed. If you read the writings of the founding fathers of Al-Qaeda, they had a major problem with U.S. foreign policy, with U.S. interventions in the Middle East. It was not, as Bush said at the time, they hate us for our freedom, for our democracy. Denmark, France, most other countries who are also liberal democracies were not necessarily attacked, even though later some were. So you have radical fringes in the Muslim world. We should have shown no naivete about this. There is a jihadist threat. However, turning this into a civilizational war and using an exclusively securitarian way of looking at the entire Islamic world is a tragic mistake. And this is precisely what bin Laden wanted. He wrote it very clearly in 1997. He wanted the United States to attack the Muslim world in order to sharpen the contradictions. He used basically the old anarchist playbook. Propaganda by the deed, striking hard, and then sharpening the contradictions within the Muslim world and within America to create these two opposite blocks that he thought would help him win this asymmetrical war.
Yeah, the Pew Research Institute finds that a growing number of U.S. citizens are hostile to Muslims. 4 in 10 Americans now view Islam negatively. It's even become a partisan issue. According to this survey, more than 3/4 of Republicans this year said that the Islamic religion promotes violence, whereas fewer than 1/3 believe that was the case shortly after 9/11. Reed Brody, the clash of civilizations that bin Laden wanted, he's got it?
Well, as Karim Bitar said, I think the government responded just as bin Laden would have wanted. And I want to push back a little on George Bush. I mean, a couple of days after 9/11, Bush signs a secret directive authorizing the CIA to detain people with no charges, no lawyers, no oversight. The White House counsel says the Geneva Conventions are obsolete. Dick Cheney says America is going to have to work on the dark side. And that was the start of this global war on terror. No geographic limits, an enemy nobody could define. Let's remember what came out of that. Guantanamo, where we saw the Muslim prisoners, dressed in orange and handcuffed. Abu Ghraib, the humiliation. Secret CIA prisons on 3 continents. Waterboarding. George Bush personally approved the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's one of the masterminds, presumably of 9/11, who's still not on trial because of that waterboarding, and all of these policies that were sold to us as a way to make America and the world safer. I mean, they've obviously, as we're discussing, done the opposite. I mean, Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib became the symbols of the United States in the Muslim world. I mean, Joe Biden, before when he was still a senator, said Guantanamo had become the best propaganda tool that exists for recruiting terrorists in the world. And then we saw the pictures of Abu Ghraib, and we were told, oh no, this is just some bad apples. And Colin Powell said, look at America, watch how we're gonna do the right thing. Well, we didn't. And none of the people who are responsible for waterboarding, for Guantanamo, for the secret prisons, Abu Ghraib, the only people who've ever been prosecuted in the U.S. are the people who are in the pictures of Abu Ghraib. Never the top-ranking people, never, the George Bushes. And so I think, we had an opportunity to see the world 9/11 more deeply and to react in a way that would have created a safer world. And we just didn't take that opportunity. And that's on a lot of people, but it's not also on George Bush.
Well, as promised, we can now go to Jerusalem. Jocelyne Cesari is chair of religion and politics at the University of Birmingham. Thanks for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Did this play out the way you expected when you think back 25 years ago?
Certainly not. You know, first there was a shock, and then as a scholar of religion and politics, everything changed after 9/11. I was in the U.S. starting to work in academia there, and I arrived a little before 9/11. And all my colleagues could not care less about religion in international affairs. What has changed since then is that nobody can say that religion doesn't matter, but we are still not able to really understand or even anticipate what religion can do on the international level. And even more than that, we have been focusing on Islam only or mostly in the last 25 years, like forgetting or neglecting the importance of religions, all of them, on the international scene, and not only for war or conflict, but for all other kind of issues, from climate change to economic or financial stability. There are lots of things going on in the religious world that affect international issue, but we are still looking at the security entry and the Islam entry. And I think it defeats the purpose, meaning to try to understand what religion does internationally.
So that just to be clear for our viewers, Jocelyne, just to be clear for our viewers, are we talking here about religion which goes from some faiths that are very egalitarian, promote peace, to others that promote wars? Are we talking about religion, or are we talking about radicality?
I'm talking about all religion, in the sense that we have in Myanmar a Buddhist state that promote monk warriors. And sometimes I give my students some of their text and I remove the origin, and they all think that it's jihad. They are responsible of a genocide of Muslims in Myanmar, okay? So, and we consider Buddhism as a religion of peace and love, don't we? So that is the kind of thing we are not paying attention to. So it's not that one faith is more radical than the other. From the work I do, all faiths at different moments are able to the most atrocious violence, all of them.
And is the world a more radical place? Is the world a more radical place than it was back then, 25 years ago?
No, I would not say this. I said that the radicalization has become more and more difficult for people to accept coming from religion. We are ready to accept radical acts from secular governments. We can complain about it, but when it comes to religion, there is the assumption that it's not right. While we know across history that religion have been responsible for a lot of violence, but also secular ideology, communism, fascism, you know. So again, what I'm saying here, we should not think that religion is special. It does have potential to violence. It does have also potential for healing and conflict resolution. And the only way to look at it is to look at it is what are the conditions that enable violence for any religion, and what are the conditions that prevent violence. And I cannot see anybody in my discipline, in political science, but even more, for me, it's even more worrisome, not even in policymaking. We are still looking at Islam as it is the religion of violence. Of course, all the facts are there. They are jihadi. I'm sorry I could not join because of all your technical issues before, but I don't know if you have talked about jihadis, but jihadis is one entry of the way that Islam is appearing on the international scene. And it's still there. And we are still not able to really counter it. It's metamorphosing, changing, taking different form from 9/11 and the operation on the Twin Tower and what it is now. Lots of things have changed, but our apparatus, the way we are dealing with it, has not changed much. And it's part also of the inefficiency of really countering it in different contexts.
Karim-Émile Bitar, again, I don't know if you've heard, but there's a presidential election in this country coming up in the spring. We're hearing the stigmatization of one religion by the far right. Your thoughts on, again, how people talk about religion in 2026 compared to 2001?
It's become hegemonic in the public discourse. You open certain TV channels in France and you have the impression that they only talk about Islam or immigration or insecurity, which they consistently correlate with Islam. And what happened 48 hours ago in Paris is a perfect example of what Professor Césari was saying. You know, at the Eiffel Tower, the administrators of the Eiffel Tower were receiving a foreign delegation. And it was a Hindu delegation. But when those Hindus asked for gender segregation, for women not to appear in the
No women staffers.
No women staffers. Surprisingly, the administrators said okay. And it did not occur to them that religious radicalism could be found among Hindus. And as it was correctly said, it is a worldwide trend. In all major religions, we are witnessing the rise of extremist messianic circles. But also the problem is that we should not use religion as a single explanation for everything that happens. There is a tendency in old Orientalist trope, whenever something happens between Morocco and Indonesia, people think it is because there is a Quranic verse that says this or that. We fail to take into consideration the history, the demography, the economy, the social issues, the psychological dimensions, the impact of Western interventions, and we think that religion explains it all. The Quran was exactly the same in the 1960s, and you had legions of miniskirts in Egypt and in Algeria. What happened is, during the 1980s, when America wanted to defeat the Soviet Union, it relied extensively on those radical Islamist jihadists. It sent them to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. So America, with its allies, Saudi Arabia and Pakistani intelligence services, bears a significant part of responsibility in the rise of these radical Islamist groups, because we thought we could use them to defeat the Soviet Union and then forget about it. The problem is that they turned their weapons against the United States a few years later. There's this movie with Tom Hanks, The World According to Charlie Wilson, who was the senator who would provide those weapons to the Afghans, and he warned against post-Soviet Union collapse, and no one took him seriously, and today we are still paying the price. Hillary Clinton said it bluntly that in the 1980s, U.S. policy consisted in helping those guys, and even Ronald Reagan once welcomed them in the Oval Office and even said they were freedom fighters, and other politicians compared them to the moral equivalents of the founding fathers. So this flirtation between some American politicians and radical Islamists, we ended up paying a very heavy price for it.
All right. So the Cold War laid the groundwork.
Absolutely.
For September 11th. Now the question is, how much September 11th laid the groundwork for today? And that's something that Reed Brody brought up a moment ago. The United States abides by a principle that dates back to the Middle Ages. It's called habeas corpus. Anyone can challenge the lawfulness of their detention in a court of law. That principle put to the test with the establishment of that offshore military prison at the U.S. base in Guantanamo, Cuba, also in the name of fighting terror. The government's surveillance powers were widened in 2002 when the Bush administration founded the Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security, which oversees the same Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, whose expanded powers under the current U.S. presidents have made headlines. Reed Brody, Not many people today think of George W. Bush, though, when they see what happened in Minneapolis and other places, do they?
Well, you know, given who we have as president today, it almost, you know, there's even nostalgia for George Bush. I mean, you know, you're asking the wrong person. I wrote 4 Human Rights Watch reports on abuses committed against Muslims during the Bush War on Terror, including one which lays out the grounds for criminal investigation of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Tenet. You know, but you know, we had, I mean, things go in waves. I mean, but obviously, a lot of this militarization, the making everything about security as opposed to human rights, a lot of it comes from you know, the U.S. responses to 9/11, you know, the Patriot Act that gave the government very wide powers to arrest people. Tens of thousands of Muslims were arrested for no reason. I mean, we talked about waterboarding. Bush approved 183 times he subjects somebody to water torture. Black sites, I mean, and, you know, everything became the entire world, and not just the United States, because everybody copied what the United States did. The war on terror became the excuse, you know, for human rights violations around the world. And you know,
so in other words, what you're telling me then is that, in a way, Osama bin Laden did win, in the sense that the human rights and the rule of law that are the cornerstones of our liberal democracies has been permanently undermined?
Probably not permanently. I mean, many Americans are fighting, yeah, you know, to restore the rule of law in the United States. But, you know, that impunity and that system is still with us. I mean, you showed Guantanamo. I was in Guantanamo twice. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the presumed mastermind of 9/11, has still not faced trial 25 years later. And, you know, throughout the world, I think, but particularly, I mean, you know, in the United States, I mean, the unleashing of police powers has, you know, was really accelerated in the aftermath of 9/11.
Justine Cesari?
Yeah, I would be a little more circumspect on, you know, bin Laden as one. Again, let's take our eyes a little outside the U.S. Even if some of the rights have been jeopardized, let's not be naive. I do not know any government anyway in any democracy that doesn't use torture, period. So what happened in an open democracy is that the debate is out there. But it's true everywhere. And we have to be clear about that. And Americans have been conflicted in the last 25 years. Do we want more security or do we want more liberties? And the debate is not clear between Americans. You know, we have also to face the fact that in the last 25 years, America has been very successful at avoiding terrorist attacks on its soil from outside source, outside actors. While if you look at Europe, it has not been the case. So there are lots of things here that have to be weighed in a different way. And bin Laden is certainly not one, especially not among the billion Muslims who are still believing in possibility of equalities and human rights. And it's still very much positively seen among Muslim youth. Democracy, it's another story. But the question of rights and equality between people and protection by the law, this is something Muslims living in a lots of authoritarian and despotic regime are still looking for.
Justine, let me ask you then about Europe, more specifically, because Today, it's no longer a fringe position among European politicians to, when they say they're defending Christian civilization, something that you didn't hear much 25 years ago. Again, is that the same thing?
No, because again, when they say Christian civilization, they are exactly in the clash of civilization that you were discussing before. They are not religious. I mean, they would be horrified by the agenda of a Christian or evangelical group in the US about abortion, contraception. They are very secular, but they look at Christianity as a borderline, as a sort of marker of belonging. It doesn't matter if you believe really or if you behave as a Christian. But for them, it's exactly what the continuous war against Islam in the last 25 years has created. Oh, we are Christian and not Muslims. And actually, it's also interesting to see that on the left side, you have the same discussion wrapped up indeed in the question of liberal values, fundamental core values about equality that Islam is supposedly challenging. So the clash of civilization is not only a right-wing discourse. It's also in the left. And you showed some of the polling that have not changed much in the last 15 years. Everywhere, Islam is seen as negatively affecting, changing, transforming the question of equality, especially between gender, and the question of civility and tolerance. So I would say we are living indeed the clash of civilization, and in this sense, indeed, the jihadi had understood this very, very early, and that's what they wanted. But they have not completely eradicated the aspiration for human rights and protection by the law everywhere, I hope.
Karim-Emile Bitar, on this point, is there?
Well, first, I do agree with her that bin Laden has not won. Al-Qaeda's original model has weakened considerably. However, jihadism has sort of metastasized rather than disappeared. We should not exaggerate the influence of these movements in the Muslim world. An overwhelming majority of Muslims reject jihadism and reject bin Laden.
Okay, so here's a question for you. The new president of Syria, he was an al-Qaeda member at one point. Now, what, has he become more moderate? Has he changed his politics? Or is he just more pragmatic?
He's pragmatic. He's also being groomed by certain foreign powers, by Turkey, by the UK to a certain extent. However, he did not change his DNA. He's also starting to introduce gender segregation in certain schools. So we have reasons to worry about the future of Syria. There are culture wars everywhere. We live in the age of culture wars in Syria and in the United States. What was also said about Christian nationalism is important. Within Christianity, you have a divide between those who believe in the Christianism of the gospel and those who only want to say, I'm not Muslim. A few days ago, Peter Thiel actually compared Pope Leo to the Antichrist. So you have this current in the United States and in the West identifying as heirs to the Judeo-Christian civilization. And here again, this expression is rather problematic because we had 2,000 years of rabid anti-Semitism in the Christian world. So today, talking about a Judeo-Christian civilization facing a homogeneous Muslim world is also quite problematic. So we have to keep into consideration that in every single country, there is a divide between identitarian Christian or identitarian Muslims and those who just want to practice their faith, whether the values of the gospel or the values of the Quran that can bring them appeasement, that can bring them peace. The religion is not necessarily the root of all evil. It's not necessarily the opium of the people. Some of the worst totalitarian regimes in the 20th century were secular regimes, and some of the worst, actually the worst terrorist wave was the anarchist radical leftists in the late 19th century who assassinated dozens of world leaders, including President McKinley of the U.S., President Sadi Carnot of France, several European kings and queens. So it's not Islam itself that is the originator of terrorism in all periods. World champions of suicide attacks are the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka. They belong to Hinduist families originally, but they are Marxists, Atheists, Leninists.
All right, Reed Brody, again, it's interesting because 25 years on, culture wars make for good TV ratings, if we're being very cynical. But, you know, at the beginning of the show, we played a clip of a mayor of New York City who was elected while being a Muslim. So is the reality of our daily lives different from the arguments that we read about in the newspapers?
I think that's an important thing. I mean, when people know neighbors who are Muslim, who are Jewish, who are Black, it's much harder. We right now we have, unfortunately, a president, Donald Trump, you know, has always mastered pitting Americans against each other for political, gain. I mean, you know, Barack Hussein Obama, one of Trump's, first acts back in office in 2017 was the so-called Muslim ban when he first came into office, an executive order blocking entry into the U.S. from several Muslim majority countries. I think he said, we have to stop all this, every Muslim from coming in until we can figure out what's going on. Mandani, we talked about, he became mayor despite intense attacks on him just for being a Muslim and for criticizing Israel. Michigan right now is a live example. The Democratic candidate for Senate, Abdul El Said, who would be the first Muslim senator in history. Trump called him a man of hate, who hates Jews with a burning passion in his heart. J.D. Vance said he was evil. And every time a Muslim in American political life, seeks office, we get this kind of attack. But I think when people, in reality, I was attorney general in New York. I lived much of my life in New York City. I mean, it's a wonderful mosaic of different religions and ethnic groups. Most Americans are good people. I think if we didn't have so much hate driven by politicians for political gain, it would be much easier to create the kind of society we want.
All right, running a little short on time, but I want to go around the room once to ask each one of the panelists what this 25th anniversary means to them. Justine Césari, let me begin with you.
If I look at America, the first commemoration the year after 9/11 was one of national unity. And what we are witnessing now is division. You have several locations of commemoration, and it tells a lot. And you talked about Mamdani, it tells a lot about the state of division of the country. And that is, in my opinion, very worrisome, because no democracy can operate on a split society. Second, for me, we are still, jihad is still a threat. It may be less a threat to the US, as we said, but it's very active in Africa and in other parts of the world that are not directly in our, on our
that don't
horizon,
always get the coverage that they deserve. Karim Emile Bitar, what will you be going through your mind this Friday?
I would say that the major lesson of the past 25 years is that Bin Laden and the most extreme Islamophobes in the West share the same assumption that Muslims and the West constitute two fundamentally incompatible worlds. And we should reject this premise. The most important fault lines throughout the world today are frequently intra-civilizational rather than inter-civilization. It's within every civilization that we're witnessing the deepest conflicts. Sunnis against Sunnis, Islamists against secularists, Shiites against Shiites or against Sunnis, authoritarians against liberals and progressives, nationalists against cosmopolitan, and increasingly populists are tending to win even in the West. So the problem with the legacy of 9/11 is that liberal democracy is jeopardized throughout the world, and it's weaker than ever, even in the heartland in the United States.
Reed Brody, what will you be thinking about very briefly, because we're out of time on Friday?
I think about all the people who lost their loved ones. I mean, I know many people who have family members who are lost, and I think, you know, we owe it to them to build a world in which of less hatred and of less division.
Thank you so much for joining us today from San Sebastian. I want to thank Jocelyn Cesari for being with us from Jerusalem. Karim Emile Bitar, thank you for being with us here. We'll have full coverage, of course, live of those September 11th commemorations. You're watching France 24.